We interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
So yeah, I was, you know, telling you earlier, I had just gotten on the SWAT and I was, you know, kind of, you know, this is it. This is what you wanted to be. And first day I go out, got a new partner. They kind of want to put you together. We're rolling on the streets doing I think it was like, you know, one of those saturations. He sees a car, he wants to stop the car. We stop it. This guy had a reputation of always finding, you know, guns, drugs, everything you want. So I'm like, you know, this dude, he's been on there for like 9 years. You know, he's the man. I'm brand new. You don't want to get in trouble. So pull him over, light him up, pulls the guy out, got dope, got guns or whatever. Got those cuffs on him. We're taking him into the back. And we didn't have a cage, so we had to call, like, patrol. About to get on the radio, and we get a hot call, like, shots fired or whatever. I hear him, like, this dude, I mean, he's swole, like, really hard charging guy. Kind of dude you would look up to. And he's like, man, it's your lucky day. Jumps in the car, you know, hit the lights. We're starting to roll. We get, like, you know, onto the scene. I'm just kind of like, you know, he's super confident, just chill this whole time. And he's all of a sudden, like, he's kind of nervous. Like, something's going on. We get out. Nothing to the call, you know, as usual. By the time you get there, they've already, like, moved out. I'm like, dude, like, what's going on, man? He's, like, looking around. He's like, man, I think I left my cuffs on that dude. I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, you know, like, got caught up, you know. He'd always talk about his gorilla blood. He's like, that gorilla blood was pumping. I think we got a shots fired call, man. I'm ready to roll. And I was like, dude, what are we going to do? He's like, we got to go find that dude. I'm like, you know how it is. Like, that address that was on his license, like, that, you don't know what that is. Like, you're like, dude, it's like 10 o'clock at night. How are we going to go find this dude? So we spend the next couple hours. Dude, we're just beating the bushes looking for this dude. Anybody, you know, and it's like, we don't know a street name. So it's like, do you know Jerome? And they're like, no, I don't know Jerome or whatnot. And, you know, dude, it's getting rough. And finally the radio, we get a call from the sergeant. Hey, you know, car 59, give me a call. I'm like, all right. You know, I'm brand new. So he's like, yeah, give him a call. I'm just an idiot. Like, yeah, I got you. I give him a call. I'm like, what up, Sarge? What's going on? He's like, did you guys arrest somebody? I'm like, nah, sorry, we didn't arrest somebody. He's like, that's weird, because dispatch just got a call from some kid that can't get out of the cuffs that one of our cars put on him. He's over there, you know, he's calling to be like, some guy jumped out of a car, you know, plain clothes with a body armor, slapped some cuffs on me, and then just drove off. And I'm like, dude, you know, and he's just kind of leave me hanging. I'm like, man, is this a joke? What do you do? And, you know, so then you kind of get in the truthfulness but you don't want to rat the guy out. And I'm like, you know, I'm just a new guy. Like, I'll ask him, we'll figure it out. So we get the thing, we get his address, we roll over to the dude's house, and like, he's, you know, in there, like, trying to cut cuffs off with a freaking, like, some BS saw or whatever. And, you know, he takes the cuffs off. He's like, man, let that be a lesson to you. You know, don't do crime or whatever. And so he gets back in the car, and I'm just like, dude, this is not how I imagine my first day of SWAT going. Because I know, like, when I go back, they're going to be like, hey, man, everybody's going to hear about it, you know. And then after that, there's pictures of cuffs everywhere and little open your drawer, and there's all these plastic cuffs. And I was like, man, this is not how I planned this to start out.
Yeah, definitely. I don't remember that scene in any kind of action movie or the movie SWAT or any of that. Like, everybody's just dialed in, loading their gear up, you know, have their kid on, and they're just locked, like, in.
And the worst part of all that is, like, those stories, like, they never go away. So, like, when I got on there, they had a new guy that had been on the team for a while, and then he left and he came back, and now he was a sergeant. So he's got to be the dude in charge. Like, literally, we go hit like a warrant, one of my very first warrants, and he goes to throw this bang in, right? He's like, I'm gonna throw this bang. And like, you're a sergeant, you're not supposed to be doing that. You're supposed to be the back of stack, but you know, he's got to like do his dominant thing. Chucks this bang in, and like, you know, we were taught you back in those days, you would crash the bang, you run in after it.
Okay,
so he throws it in. I think I was like the one or two man. I go in, I'm like getting ready to eat it. I'm like, nothing. Dude sitting on the couch playing a video game, just like, what's going on? And shit. I'm like, damn, like, we got some busted ass bangs here or whatever. And, you know, we do our thing, search the house, whatever. And I go pick it up, and like, once again, I'm a new guy, right? I pick it up. Dude's got tape on it still. He didn't take the tape off. No pen, but it's got tape in it. And I'm like, you know, I know how everybody's busting everybody's balls. So I'm like, do I go bust the sergeant's balls with his like tape thing or whatever? Or like, more than that, like, what do you do with this live bang? And it was like, those things, man, like being on SWAT was just, you know, you talked about the movies, but it was just, if they could make a reality show of what it's really like when you're downtime, like that stuff is just like, you could make $1 million, like the jokes and stuff.
Yeah. So everybody listening can hear the voice of the guest here today. And fortunately, he's got a good, strong Southern accent like I do. Yeah. So that's good. We can understand one another. We got Josh Hood on here. He's an author. Published about 6 books now, if my math is right. I could be off by 1 or 2. And
it's, we're gonna 9, get in, but who's counting?
9. Right. Yeah. But his background is really, really strong in police work. You heard some of that we just started out with. And the military, we're gonna get into all of that. Your history in the infantry, your time there, and as well as police background and what that means getting into the writing field, how you got into it, how plugged in you are now, how your new book, The Guardian, is out there, which obviously people need to pick it up. And I can guarantee you, after this episode drops and people watch it or see it or hear it, we'll start getting messages, because a lot of people that listen to us were either talking about music in messages back and forth or books. And it's nice that people still actually, you know, read and want books that are dialed in the way yours are, and your characters are actually accurate with what they do, the scenery and that sort of thing. So it's just like, I've got, you know, The Guardian, I've been reading it, been really, really impressed with the cover art and just the handling of it. I'm going to nerd out for a second, because sometimes books don't have that heavy feel or that dust cover that's just solid. Like when you're walking by, you look at the book. I mean, people say don't judge a book by its cover, but that's exactly what we do.
Yeah.
And if the cover's weak or looks like something that's kind of been done before, it doesn't draw me in. But with this cover, I dig the dark burgundy. I think Blackstone did a good job with the quality of it itself.
Yeah, they helped me. They let me design, because they usually, you get like a bunch of like a sheet and it'll have proofs on there. And this is one of the first times, like, I guess my first 2 books, I got to kind of help with the cover, but this time, you know, they're like, what do you think? I was like, man, it had some like oranges in there instead of the burgundy. It was like different. And I was like, I don't know. Like, I see, like, you know, this, you know, I kind of explained what I was seeing, and you have, like, you know, sent some pictures, like have a dude here doing this and whatever. And they worked with me the whole time. And I think like that cover turned out sick, because, you know, it just, besides the visuals, like, they really put a lot into the quality of, like, their ink. Like, you know, not to, like you said, nerd out, but like, you can feel different paperweights. Like, you can feel, you know, they use a real embossed, like, they put some time and some money into that cover. And it, I think that, you know, sometimes you write a really good book and the cover's not so great, you kind of feel like cheated. But this time, like, I felt like they came, you know, out like, just guns blazing. I feel like they did everything right. They let me have the narrator I wanted on the audiobook.
Oh, and, okay.
I'm really, just really impressed with Blackstone.
Yeah, I was too when I picked it up, and I was like, okay, it seems like the equivalent to me growing up and listening to music, and you have like these corporate record labels that'll have a really good band, and then they put out this album, and the art on the album is just blah or bland or just, it doesn't catch the eye. And then you got like this strong, you know, record label that knows the artist and the band is solid, the way it seems like with them. Like, they know, the writers know what they want, and they're really good at what they do. Let them have some insight, and you can see it then, like on the cover, it does. It captures it. It's kind of like, to me, when I look at it, it just kind of quickly strikes back to, I don't know. I don't want to say like the action movie realm, but like, I just want to like know more, you know what I'm saying? It's not just the standard cover is back. Anyway, you see the cover, people can see it. But I do want to get into how I know this is your most recent book, but going back, you did Treadstone series from the Jason Bourne characters. If you don't mind talking about that a little bit, because I know quite a few people out there that anytime I mention you and talk about that series or even having those characters, some people are even like, oh, I didn't know they were carrying on that series, you know what I mean? Or the Treadstone program.
Yeah, well, you know, that was like one of those things that you look back on it, because I think I wrote four, and then I think they decided to kind of like end that series there. But the way it had happened was just like totally out of the blue. I get a call, good friends with another author, awesome human, Mark Graney. And we had gone to BoucherCon, I think it's like 2000. It's like a writer's convention. We went there and I got to meet his editor. And we were just talking, actually, because I've been playing with the idea of writing a cop book for a while, but it's hard to kind of get there, going from military to that. And so we were talking about what that would look like, you know, how to transition. And somewhere during the conversation, this idea of, he's like, I might have something for you, is what he said, because it's real kind of like, it was real hush hush. I might have something for you. Don't like start anything else. And so I was like, okay. I think like the next week I get a call and it's about, hey, Robert Ludlum, who wrote the Bourne thing, their estate is looking to start a spinoff. At the time, they'd had a show, I think it was on USA, and some books were to go along with that. Were you interested? And I'm like, yeah, I'm interested. Like, you know, who doesn't like Jason Bourne, right? And who hadn't watched those movies? And so they gave me this opportunity to read what they were kind of doing for the movies and the show. And I was like, man, for me, like Jason Bourne is always going to be that Matt Damon, that feel, that gritty kind of movie thing. And I was like, I feel like we need something like that. And, you know, they kind of gave me, let me write this, I think it was like 25 page kind of tryout. And I just had my son at the time. It was our first kid. And as I'm thinking of like how to do this, originally it was going to be like after Treadstone had shut down, and then they decided to change that halfway through the book. But I was thinking along that lines, like what happens to like some government assassin when all of a sudden they're like, hey, we just got closed by the government because this is illegal. You know, you don't have like a 401k plan. You don't have like, you're just out on the street. And the only thing you can't put like any job history on. Like at Walmart, what'd you do? Well, I killed people for like 10 years. And so I was just kind of fascinated, like what would happen, you know, I just also like gotten out of, the sheriff's department. So I was going through that transition where you have all these skills that aren't really applicable in the world. And so like these things just came together and I was thinking, well, what would happen if, you know, you got a kid, you got a family, but you're dealing with PTSD and your wife's like, dude, you know, these things you're not dealing with, like they're dangerous around our child. And, you know, you're trying to start over. And so like, that's where that came from. And it was, just trying to do something a little different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I would assume nowadays, it's not like it was maybe 30 or 40 years ago. You know, people pick up a book now, read it, and they can post reviews. They can email you or contact you on social media and you can get like immediate feedback. You know, where 30, 40 years ago, maybe at a book signing, an author gets some feedback or, you know, maybe, you know, like fan mail, but then you guys kind of sit down and read through the mail that's going to come into your office or whatever. I do like that aspect that people can reach out to authors, talk to them, you know what I mean? Like have more of that interaction. And I do hope book signings continue to carry on, you know, like Mark came through our area. Back probably 10 months ago, 8-10 months ago. And I'm sitting there at the book signing and there's probably about 6 or 7, off-duty officers from my department. I mean, we're all in plain clothes cause we're off duty, you know, enjoying him talking and talking about his book. And then, a retired, SWAT guy, you know, from my department was there as well. Avid reader, but we all sit around and talk after him. And Mark made time for us, which was cool. They all got to talk to him and stuff, but so it was like, you know, afterwards we sat around the parking lot, talked for like an hour. And one of the off-duty like sergeants, he had been talking and was like, hey, I noticed that that some of these officers are like kind of just checking out, like they're getting off duty. They're, you know, plugging into watching movies all the time. Some guys, you know, that we knew about were drunk and just kind of like not living a healthy lifestyle on their off time and not recharging something, you know, internally in their brain, like just getting inactive. Right. And he was just an avid reader. So he started pushing some officers. And I want to say there's like five of the officers that were there, and they were all reading Mark's books, Jack Carr's books. And so we started talking. I was like, y'all need to check out Hood stuff. So like, oh, okay. You know, so it was like one of those things where I got to see firsthand these young motivated officers that were also getting plugged into reading in their off time as being a little more positive and not, you know, just saturated or kind of checking out. So it's pretty cool. So now I'm waiting to hear back from them what they think of the Guardian, because a couple of them have picked it up. So it's pretty cool. It's the power of books that I think people have even talked about audiobooks. You mentioned earlier, I've yet to listen to an audiobook. I want to, because I love to hear narration, but it's one of those things where some people have been like, man, audiobooks is, that's the death of reading. I'm like, I know guys who did not read books. I would go to work and talk about reading books, and they were just like, whatever. But then audiobooks come along, and they're coming to work, and like one of my buddies is like, hey man, have you read that Beastie Boys biography? I'm like, nah. It's like, oh, let's do it on audiobook. You got to check it out. So now he's plugged in to books that normally he wouldn't necessarily read because he didn't have time, but driving, he can listen to them on audiobooks. So I need to check into that.
Yeah, that's one thing, you know, having kids and I mean, because you're getting two different things, right? And I feel like our culture is like, you know, you have this concept of like open batch versus closed batch thinking. Like back in the day when we grew up, you have like, you know, you write a physical book, you got your hands on it, you know, you turn it in, like there's no like ebooks or anything. So to get what, you know, for someone to experience that, they go to the library, they go to buy, and they buy this physical book and they read these, you know, word by word. And so like that's kind of started to like change, because people want like a podcast is like a living thing, you know, it's like you can sit down, you have this conversation, and then like people can respond to that conversation online, they can watch it, they can, you know, do whatever. And so then you have like TikTok and Instagram, these things are like open batch. There's like, they keep going. They don't stop. It's not like with a book, there's beginning and an end. It's as I'm writing it, you know, it might take me, let's say it takes a year to write it. Like the things that I'm writing about are no longer really present. I mean, they're no longer current, right? This world's moving so fast and everything. So it's already kind of like outdated. And I feel like a lot of people now are kind of moving into this new mindset where it's like you have this continuous now of all these all this information and, you know, stuff, and it's like, hey, is it relevant, is it whatever? And but they like that kind of like back and forth, like being at a live concert, you know. It's so much different than hearing the same song on the radio or on the radio or whatever, you know. There's an energy that goes with it. And so I think the audiobooks are kind of like bridging that gap. And I listen to them just because, you know, it's like when you have family, you have kids, you have whatever, you don't have the freedom to be like sitting down like, oh, I can't wait to read this book. You know, they're like, dad, like I just, you know, flush something down the toilet. And you're like, why would you do that? And so, you know, it's kind of like, you can listen to a book when you're driving, you can listen to a book when you're working out, you can listen to a book when you're cooking dinner, or giving the kids a bath or whatever. And, but you're just like music and everything else, you know, as an author, I'm still reading these books, right? Mm-hmm. I'm listening, but I'm not getting the same thing that I'm getting from reading a book. Like, I don't understand. I don't get to see how he wrote that sentence. I don't get to like feel how like that word is, you know. It's like, where do you put the period? Where do you put the comma? Like, what does that word mean? Hold on, let me put this book down and like look it up. Yeah. You know, those types of things. Like, how did he structure the paragraph? How did he structure this sentence? And so you're losing a lot of stuff with that convenience. But I know that, you know, the audio market is getting really big, while it seems like maybe the hardback market's not as big. What's really interesting is they're trying to do these fusions now where they have like they'll throw sound effects into some of these books. And so like you'd be like, he's like, and then he went down the thing and then, you know, he's running and then you hear this, you know, and it's like, and I don't know. I can't really get behind that. Like, I understand what they're trying to do, but it's like, it's interesting.
It sounds like it's weird, like how things work, like in a cycle. Cause that would have been like old radio, you know, the old radio shows, but before our time, but it was a whole crew of people making sound effects and people acting like plays out or whatever, you know, or radio shows. So it's weird how like that's now coming back where,
well, I mean, isn't that what a podcast is? Because like, I think like the advent, I was listening to Jack Carr and I think he had Malcolm Gladwell on. So they're talking about like back in the 40s or 50s, 60s, whatever, you'd have like these, you know, even with the Late Show and something like that's how you get to know like, oh, Johnny Depp or, you know, I remember when the Beastie Boys came on and they played Sabotage on David Letterman. Mm-hmm. You're like, that was like a big break from what they'd done. And like, you're watching them play the guitar. You're like, I didn't know that. And then you sit down and they're talking to them and everything. And so like, but we've moved into this thing where like the news is now like, it's not like, it used to be you'd have these intimate kind of conversations and you had like a long time ago, they had that the War of the Worlds where the guy like on the radio, I think it was Orson Welles or whatever. Mm-hmm. And like people thought it was real and it like, they like freaked out. Right. And so like, it feels like the podcast is going back to like the importance of getting to know people, the power of a conversation, you know, and I wonder as we like move forward and things become more complex, I don't mean to feel old, but I'm always catch myself being like, damn, you know, like it was so much easier back in the day, like hop on your BMX bike or your, you know, skateboard and you'd be out playing with your friends. And then you're like, man, is that light on yet? Because I know I got to be home and that light's on. Yeah. I was like, I was telling my son, I was like, dude, you guys are so sheltered, you know, because my wife was supposed to sign my son up for soccer and she forgot to do it. So the only way we could get on a soccer team was if I agreed to coach it. So I was been coaching my son's soccer team and he's six. And, you know, you're seeing these kids and the first day we get out there and they're acting crazy. I'm like, dude, all right, if y'all can't pay attention, we're going to go run. So I'm like 43 and we're running a lap, you know, we get like halfway around this lap and these kids are like, oh God, I'm like tired. This one kid's like, Mom, I think I need my inhaler. And I'm like, dude, what? Like an inhaler? She's like, yeah, he's got an inhaler. You know, he doesn't like running. And I'm like, does anybody know what soccer is before you signed your kid up? Like, that's all it is running. You don't even score sometimes. You just run. Like, you know. And so I'm telling my son, like, I was like, man, you kids sit here. And part of it's my fault, but I let y'all watch your shows and everything. Like, back when we were up growing up, like, we didn't have any of this crap. Mm-hmm. You know, we didn't have, like, you had Saturday morning cartoons, and when you saw that Soul Train come on, it was time to get outside, you know? And it was like, outside, you're thirsty, you're drinking out of the hose. And he doesn't believe me, right? And I'm like, dude, I'm going to tell you how bad it was when we were growing up. When I was growing up, at 10 o'clock on the news, they would come up a thing that, like a little marquee that would say, it's 10 o'clock, do you know where your kids are? To remind the parents that their kids, do you remember that? I was like, dude, that's I was raised by people that had to be reminded by television that their kids were still outside. Yeah. And, you know, and now we're like, so these kids are so sheltered. And it was like, that freedom was awesome.
Yeah. My mom was very good at that. Like, so I grew up, you know, single mother and an older brother. He's about 3 years older than me. And that's how it was. Like basically she'd kick you out the door, like go play, go do whatever. And then you come back, you come in the house, you get a little snack or something, and you run back out. But you were right when you talked about the streetlight. One of those things that she said was like, always, I don't care what y'all do. Like, just one, you know, obviously don't go out and break the law, but just tell me where you are. So literally we could just be like, all right, hey, we're going to skate. I mean, like 2 miles away. We'd go down to like our cousin's house, which is like 2 miles away. Skate around there all day. And like you were talking about, you basically hijack people's hoses in their backyard to get water. And then you keep moving. But we'd skate all over this apartment complex and stuff, playing like the sewer tunnels that they connect like
those.
And then we would skate all the way back. So we would literally be gone 8-9 hours during the summer, during the day. But that was her thing. Is like, as long as I know where you are, I don't care what you do. And so it just kind of gave me the freedom to explore, to skate. Like, and then we just kind of had this crew of like these kids that would all come over and we would skate all day. And they were all, you know, 2 or 3 years older than me. And then listening to music. It's like you were talking about with skating, you sort of build that resilience of, you know, you slam, and we were launching off ramps. You know, I was like 10 years old when I'm launching a ramp.
Unsafe ramps.
What's that?
Unsafe ramps. You know, it's like ramps that were built by trash, and you just built something. Like, hey, let's go jump this. And then, like, that was the thing I was telling my son is, like, with us, it was like, I knew if we go back and it's not time to eat, you're going to be cleaning something. You're going to be doing a chore. You're going to be doing something. So you would literally have to, like, triage your own injuries. You know, and learning to skate, you're getting banged up because, like, I mean, they didn't have skate shoes back then, or at least we could afford them. Like, I never saw a helmet. I never saw pads. Mm-hmm. And so you hit the ground, like, you're hitting your head. You're like, oh, dude, like, dude, it hurts real bad. I'm bleeding. But am I bleeding enough to go home? Like, nah, because, like, that's game over. And you're like, nah, just, you know, you're sitting there with half a concussion or whatever. But it's like,
Trying to hide your injuries.
But I think they learn, like you said, this resilience, but they learn, like we learned also, like how to interact like within a society, right? If you're a punk, like, you know, I know it's not bullying and people might say that, but if you're a punk and you're acting like a douche, like you're going to get put in your place. And if that isn't, you know, you're like, dude, you can't hang out with us anymore. And it's like that peer pressure taught you in good ways and in bad ways how to be, you know, a constructive member of society, whatever it was. And it's like, you know, I don't remember, you know, they talk about all the stuff that happens in school, bullying and other stuff like that. And like, I mean, I could be wrong, but I don't remember any like school shootings. I don't remember like any, you know, people being on antidepressants, people doing like all this stuff that we have today. Like, you know, I don't remember it being like that.
Yeah. It's a lot of, I think, you know, 20 years from now, people will study our era of psychology or our behavior now of kids in school. And you're right. It's, I think it is at a younger age, more tablet time or more computer time, and more hours in a classroom where kids are expected to just sit still. And I mean, I was pretty average as a kid. I know my brother was like very active. Brain was very active. He's very just social. So I think school sometimes he would just get bored very quickly. I was a little more lazy when it came to school. But you're right. When I was a kid, it just seemed that everybody stayed active. I do think too that the more, obviously, the more active we are, the more sunlight we're getting. But when you're accomplishing some things that you enjoy. So I enjoyed skating. So anytime I could skate, I was actually having a good time. And we would get in fights with each other, like you were saying. I'd pop off at the mouth and think that, you know, I was a little bigger than I was. And I'd get punched and body slammed. You know, been in a lot of fights when I was a young kid. And then I learned to temper my own actions. And then just like, okay, I need to check what I'm saying to someone because – they could just punch me. You know what I mean? Like I could cause a reaction. But as far as like school shootings and that sort of thing, I will say that I think the more they occur and the more they're on the news and in everyone's like forethoughts or whatever, you know, that like in like every day it's being said, the more that idea is pushed out there. So that there is if one who is whatever suffering or getting fixated on that and going, okay, this is how I can get attention, or this is how I can inflict pain on others, or whatever their motives are, that constant reminder is either on through the news, through movies. Now there are a few movies that have been made about active shooters and give you the perspective of the active shooter. And I think that when we do that as a society, it stays as maybe an option. And people would go, you're absolutely stupid. If somebody wants to go on a shooting spree, they're going to go on a shooting spree. I get that, but it's almost like now it becomes like a competition. It's more of an idea that just kind of stays in the collective thoughts, I guess. you know what I mean? I do believe.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like a single serve like problem, you know, where you're like, hey, I got this answer. It's going to fix everything. And I think, you know, from my personal point of view, like, you know, being like a Christian and believing, you know, in God and reading the Bible, a lot of it has to do with, you know, the responsibility of the man in the house. Right. And, you know, personally for me, you know, I, as a cop and as a writer and whatever, like you spend enough time away from the house and it's kind of like, your wife steps in to fill a certain things, and, you know, and like, it's easy, I guess, for me, mainly more being a writer is like, you're focused on this career or whatever you're doing. Like, I need to have this book, and like, time slips. Like, you don't realize, like, my daughter's turning 3 today. And so, like, it was just the other day, she was being bored. Right. And so my wife, like, picked up a lot of slack, taking my kids to school, to church, like, you know, reading them the Bible, like, you know, little things that like I didn't even realize, like, you know, teaching them to spell and these stuff. And so, like, as I, it was a time where I kind of got really convicted, just taking a look, like, you know, you're always moving forward, like, what's happening right now with everything. And so it made me step back and look at myself as like a man, like, air quote, you're like the head of the household, like, you know, the Bible says that, but what does that mean? And, you know, my wife is a very strong woman. She's a nurse, an ER nurse. She didn't take to like, you're going to tell her what to do because you're the man. Like, that stuff doesn't fly in my house. Yeah. And, you know, but as I began to, you know, it's not like do as I say, not as I do type thing, but you begin to look at it from the outside, at least for me, like getting past that ego. And it's like, man, I wonder, it seems to me that a lot of the failures, like, because I got a son and a daughter, so you parent different, but looking at your daughter, it's like, how many failures that have happened, terrible things in life, is simply because, like, a man has failed a woman, or a man has failed to raise a man, you know, like, he's trying to raise a son, but he's not teaching him really how to be a man. He's not teaching him what that means. And I'm not being like, oh, like, you know, all the BS macho bullshit, but like, right. Like, you know, I was taught like, don't cry when you're little, like, if you're going to cry, yeah, like, you're a baby. Right. Uh-huh. But then, like, not to be all like crazy or weird out here, but I'm like thinking about what I'm telling my son, like, don't cry. And he's like, dude's hurt. Right. I'm telling him, for me, it was all of a sudden I'm telling him, like, his emotions don't matter. And it's like,
yeah,
maybe that's where you begin to build this emotional disconnection. Like, that's what it means to be a man or something, you know, because I feel like I've checked a lot of the boxes to be like, to get my man card in life. But stepping away from it and looking back now that I'm older, I'm like, dude, that's a lot of bullshit that I bought. Like, I didn't even like read the label. I'm just shoveling this in my, yeah, this is what it means. And it's like, you know, looking back is kind of hard sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, as we get older, you know, the same thing like you're saying is like, if someone says, oh, be a man. When I hear some of that, it comes from men who are insecure. And so they are trying to boost themselves up. I think you and I both agree, when I'm talking about being a man, I'm talking about someone who can show compassion, but can also protect, you know, or can also teach, you know, and educate and help people. Like that's, to me, that's what it is. And that, I was fortunate growing up, I was around men who were that way. Like, men who were like very compassionate, funny, you know, were always teaching me things. I mean, every little thing, you know, they would teach me whatever they were doing, because they knew, you know, through my life, like, hey, these are just things that if you remember what I'm teaching you, it's going to help you when you get older.
Right.
But also those men, every one of them, could flip the switch and knock somebody out if they needed to. And it was never, ever aggressive. You know what I mean? Like, it was never in that way. And I saw my dad a few times just change that tone and body posture with other men and complete strangers, you know, in a city one time, and a dude walking up like an aggressive panhandler. Yeah. And right off the bat, my dad's behavior switched like that. My brother and I were just laughing and talking with him. He keyed in on this guy walking up to us and said some things very quickly to him. And I noticed my dad's posture changed. His arms came out a little bit and his fist started curling up. And that guy quickly read it and then kept moving. And then I was like, man, you know, like, so even at a young age, I realized, you know, it wasn't like necessarily, oh, I'm scared of my dad now because he's just going to fight this stranger. We talked about it. You know what I mean? And it was like, hey, you're not going to let people come up like that because you're going to get hurt in this world. And it was that thing between my dad, my uncles, even, you know, men who were friends of my mom. And they would always kind of take me under their wing and teach me things. Or when I got a little bit older and I told some people I was going to join the Army, you know, when I was in high school, a lot of people were like, man, that's stupid. Don't do that. But there were two or three men that were friends with my mom, very supportive. And one of the guys even, you know, took me out to dinner the last night I was, you know, getting ready to ship out, you know, go fly to Fort Benning. And he took me to dinner. And then that was one of his things was like, hey, I basically watched you grow up and I'm excited that you're joining the military. Like, this is a good thing. And, yeah. And very few people were saying that. And this guy was someone I respected a lot. I always thought about that. Like, okay, I seem to be making the right decisions. And I always wanted to kind of be that. I always wanted to be that person that could help teach, nurture, be compassionate, but also if necessary, if somebody, you know, if it has to happen, it's going to happen.
Right, right, right.
And when it's done, it's going to be that person's fault. They did everything to create, you know, the pain that they're about to feel. So I do believe that. And you and I both have been in very similar environments in different cities as police officers. And sadly, we've seen what a lack of parenting can do. And we're talking specifically about men raising men. And when we see that absence, you see gangs flourish. You see guys carrying guns at a very young age because they can't fight, but they want to go out there and start a fight or start beef. And then they lean on that gun. It's kind of chaos ensues. And then that generation has kids. And so now you're far removed now. This generation now that are 14 to like 17, they weren't even probably raised by grandparents who are locked in, you know, we're kind of seeing that. And I do wonder if we've got any kind of movements out there, like grassroots level, where men are stepping in and having to fill the role of somebody else's father, you know, because guys are checking out.
Yeah. I think, I mean, the other thing that like really, you know, is hit home having, you know, a daughter is like that. I also have like a role to be emulating to her what her husband should look like, right? Mm-hmm. Like the way I treat my wife is like they're like, you know, so I constantly pray for my, you know, my son's wife and try to think, am I like preparing him one day to be that husband and flip for, you know, my daughter? Am I preparing her to like know what right looks like, know what a man looks like, know the way she should be treated and the way like, hey, this behavior is not really acceptable. And like a lot of the, you know, they're always watching and, you know, I'm always slipping, but like, I try to like, you know, treat my wife in a way so that, you know, my daughter's like, oh, that's the way that's supposed to look. And, you know, mm-hmm. I try to emulate to my daughter that like, yeah, you know, like you said, there's so many facets to like being a man, a good man, I guess. Right. You know, mm-hmm. because you don't just like get that. I don't feel like you just like, hey, I was born with the whatever. I don't know. I'm trying not to cuss, but, you know,
yeah,
I have that. And so this is like my right. Like, you know, mm-hmm. you have to kind of like earn that every day and stuff like that. And I feel that, you know, in SWAT and stuff, I did a lot of teaching there. You know, I still write articles or whatever. And it like a lot for whatever reason within the military and within like law enforcement, you got that like, stump the chump, you can't teach me anything mentality. Like it's like this ego wall, and like mm-hmm. I can't count how many times you go to, you're standing up before all these, like you're teaching a class, like a shooting class or whatever, and like as soon as you walk up, you know, everybody's just sitting there like that, like this dude's gonna teach me something, right? And so then you got to go through this kind of ritual about like where you've been, what you know or whatever, you know, like that. And it's like kind of like this like butt sniffing thing, like, oh, could this guy teach me something? But like they're kind of like closed off, like mm-hmm. and you got to work harder, not to teach them anything, but to prove to them that they should be listening. And they're, meanwhile, they're like, you know, like missing what you're trying to do. And so, you know, I got to the point where it went from like, hey, that kind of angers me, to like, let me understand what's going on here. And then you try to go through like, hey man, let's check our egos at the door, and they're like, I'm going to an ego or whatever. And then, you know what I mean? And yeah. It's like, we already know how to do this, right? But yeah. In those like communities, there feels like there's like this fear to admit you don't know something, or fear mm-hmm. that you're not good at something. So you rather go your entire life failing at something than to take a second to be like, you know, I need to self-critique, self-correct. Let me open myself to like, I don't know everything. Like, I don't even know half the things. Like, maybe this dude can teach me something. And maybe this dude's like, you know, like some airsoft dude who's like got no creds, but he can shoot his ass off. Like, I want to know how to shoot like that guy, right? Yeah. Why does it matter that he doesn't have this or that? Mm-hmm. Or he wasn't dealt the ninja force recon, whatever. It's like,
yeah.
And so I think that goes, you know, this whole concept goes from work, not particularly work, because if a person hadn't been a cop, a first responder, fireman, whatever, or in the military, they're going to sit here and be like, what the hell are they talking about? Mm-hmm. But I do believe in these like cultures that are within the United States that are like separate, but they also serve like, you know, the greater good. Like, there are thinking that is being carried back into the household, and, you know, that maybe some people don't even know that that's what's going on.
Yes, that is, and I try to always harp on like being ego free.
Yeah,
just meaning that, because you're right, that wall. I mean, try to be like me walking into a room and explain to people, hey, we're going to talk about gangs, and the first thing they do is size me up, yeah. And they're like, oh, this dude right here looks like he can read a book, but he doesn't know the first thing about gangs, because they yeah. might see the glasses. I used to wear a lot of suits. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Now I don't. Now I just dress down. I wear a band t-shirt, you know, Vans tennis shoes or something, and a band hat or something. And one of the last presentations I did for like a large group at a conference, a gang investigators conference, it was like a 3-hour. And that's what I did. I dressed the way I normally do and just said, hey, look, like right off the bat, we need to get away from this idea that the person that walks in with the best suit, or the person that walks in with like the crisp 5'11" or whatever the flavor of the day is, tactical clothing, like get away from all that and just listen to what someone's saying and just absorb it. And if you think they're full of, you know, like BS, then block it out. But 9 times out of 10, especially in, you know, the law enforcement world or military or any field where somebody's being brought in as an expert, most of the time they know what they're talking about. You know what I mean? Like, they wouldn't be getting that opportunity to talk. And then like once I get into it, a lot of times people are like, oh man, I like this. You know, I want to talk more about it. And they have a question. If I can answer it, that leads on, because I'm long winded, I'll talk for 20 minutes on a topic, or I'll say, I don't know. Like, I don't know about that gang or the topic you're talking about. I don't know, but I'm going to try to find out. Or I'll say, hey, I might say, I don't know about, you know, you're talking about breaching doors and doing this. I may not know about that. So I'm going to get you in touch with Hood. He knows this stuff inside and out. Give him a call. This is his point of contact or whatever. That's the big thing. And it's funny, when I first started teaching gangs, you would have dudes sitting in the room and close off, you know, reading their body language. They're crossing their arms and leaning back. They're staring at me sideways. And then I hear them at the first break bragging about, you know, slamming somebody on the ground, or, oh, I got a kilo of cocaine, you know. And it's kind of like, hey, just at ease with all that. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
no one's judging one another on weight of drugs, and nobody's judging each other on your amount of uses of force. It's kind of sometimes the opposite. Maybe you're getting in a use of force because you're not thinking the situation through, you know, or you're not, you know, at least maybe dealing with people in the right way. But I do want to ask you about when you got into SWAT.
Yeah.
That, I would assume that was something that you kind of had in the back of your mind, like, hey, I wouldn't mind doing this. Or was it something like, I'm getting on SWAT one way or another. Like, I'm just going to train until I get on.
I mean, I went to the sheriff's department just to get on SWAT, you know, because I came right out of the military. It's like, what, 2009? So the economy was crap. And it's like, you know, like I'd never even thought about being a cop before. You know, I was just like, hey, let's see. You know, I got these skills. Let's see if I can use them or whatever, you know. And in a way, I was still running from the idea of being a writer. Like, I just, you know, it was still like, what does that mean? Like, you know what I mean? And so,
yeah.
Like, I was just looking for job security. So I get on there and, you know, it was just like, for us, like, we're a full-time team. So we have two full-time teams in Memphis where I live. And so, it's not good, but it's like,
oh, well,
you know, like the way it works is you have like, everybody's kind of got like a, and this is not pumping myself up because I didn't do anything. I just, you know, whatever. But, you know, you got like part-time teams with pretty much everybody's got, because like, you know, SWAT's like cool and whatever. And then you got like full-time teams and that's all they do. And like most departments that I've seen, like, they have a part-time team where a guy's like on patrol or he's in narcotics or he's whatever. And then if there's like a SWAT situation, like, you know, they go back to their car and pull out their junk or whatever. Like the team we have, like in the other cities, Houston, I don't know how many cities have full-time teams, like LA, New York, like that's all you do. Like, mm-hmm. And so you got to go try out first. And then if you make the tryout, like the school was like 6 weeks long and it's just like, you know, dude's trying to like beat the hell out of you, like you're carrying mm-hmm. logs. It's like the guy who ran it, like they had seen like that Buds class and it was like that. I'm like, damn dude, are we ever gonna learn anything or we just get the shit kicked out of us here, you know? And
yeah,
you know, my head trainer was going through a divorce at a time, so he'd come in hungover every day and he's just like, I'm gonna wreck your world, dude. And you're like, oh god. And so but it was never like a thing where I was like, it's not gonna happen. You know, people mm-hmm. play those mind games where they're like, so I got lucky. I was one of the, used to have like 3 years to get in patrol before you could even apply. Mm-hmm. And like, so I don't know how it is with you, but we don't have a bid system. Like some departments like Memphis has like a bid system. So you go someplace and if you're bid, you know, you can basically stay there. They can't throw you out because like, you know, like, so with some of them, it's like SWAT is like, I got this much time. I can bid to go there. And then if you pass the tryout, you make it, right? You really mm-hmm. can't ever get thrown out of anything. But like the way ours was like, you have to be asked to go to a specialized unit. Then you have to make it. And then if you suck, they'll kick you out. You know, so it's mm-hmm. like, it's like constantly, you got to show up like to earn that every day. And so like, I got lucky because I had the military and everything that I got to go try out at like 18 months, which before that it was like 3 years, you know, like did what I needed to do, got on there. And then it was just, it was like, I knew the car wasn't for me, you know? Uh-huh. And like, when I saw like the homicide detectives had to wear suits all the time, I was like, that's not for me, you know? Yeah. And the narco guys are like, you know, street crimes, narcotics, they're like vampires, you know? I mean, that's like a whole different world. They like shit bags. Yeah. Like, you're a cop.
Yeah.
And you know, and I was like, man, that's not really for me either, you know, because like, that's a rough gig.
Yeah. Yeah. So when you were talking about SWAT and, like when I first got on my department, we had three full-time SWAT teams and then three full-time drugs and vice teams and then two large gang suppression units. And they were pushing to have a third one. And the vision was to have a SWAT team, a plainclothes drug unit, and then gang suppression. And you all worked like the same cycle together. So if gangs had a search warrant, SWAT team would knock the door in and drugs and vice as well. And that was a pretty cool plan, but through staffing levels and then changes of command and stuff, it went away. And then they have two full-time teams now, which is still kind of unheard of. A lot of departments, like you said, kind of downsized, or they looked at a budget and said, we spend so much money on SWAT, you know, and all their training.
'Cause it ain't cheap.
Are we getting, no, exactly. But you know what I realized is when we were doing stuff, and I mean, especially like street stuff. So when I was on a gang unit or when I was in drugs and vice, it was like, sometimes you get a stop and you get that sales pitch of like, I got some drugs in this hand, or I got some weed in this hand, but I'm really looking for a gun or a shooter. Or, and 2 hours later, you're setting up a gun buy and you need a team to do a takedown, and you want that team to be squared away and fluid to where they can roll up, flash bang a car, yank people out. And then you do the debrief with the gang member and they're like, yo, that was like something out of a movie. Like, I didn't even know what to do. And then you're like, cool. Sorry that it was so like crazy for a second, but that caused you not to inadvertently grab something. And they're really good at what they do. And now we can sit here and talk about your future and what's going to happen. So I was always very, very impressed with our SWAT teams. And I always thought that's one of the best investments we can do. We should never be moving backwards and cutting our assets down as the city continues to grow and grow. I do want to ask you, what is your opinion of someone like, someone gets on a police department or sheriff's department, and then they're either go through their training, they get sworn in basically. So now they're on patrol. Should they be able to put in for a SWAT team the minute they're sworn in? Or should there be a set goal or a set time of like 18 months or 3 years? Or,
I mean, that's an excellent question. It's like, you know, so I'm going to have like a double answer here, because like, I think SWAT is different than anything else, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because like, you're not really the police, but you are the police. You know, you're not investigating stuff. Like, you're kicking doors in. And we, you know, like, I was allowed to, like my education as a cop started when I got on SWAT. But that's not, like, normal. And it was, the reason it happened is because, like, you know, we're what they called a tier one team. So, like, we had to, like, we had to be certified to work with, you know, the Coast Guard, because they had the Mississippi River. So we had to be certified, like, through stuff with the Secret Service, because we did dignitary protection. So I went to Secret Service dignitary protection school. I went to the DEA, like, drug seizure school. I went to the DEA driving school, because, like, they would call us, because, like, you know, the FBI has a regional office here. You know, the DEA has a regional office here. You know, the U.S. Marshals, like, has... So, like, we had to, like, check all these boxes, because, like, they also, you know, like, FBI can call HRT, but, like, HRT is probably not going to Memphis. You know what I mean? Like, we've I've been on a few things where I've worked with HRT, but it's, like, you know, with DEA, like, they have their DEA, like, their fast team or whatever. Like, there's a small chance they're going to come hit a warrant in Memphis, and unless it's, like, Pablo Escobar, right?
Okay.
You know, and so... You develop these relationships through narcotics and the federal money that comes through narcotics, and the way, like, not to give too much away, but you know how that works, like where the assets go. And like, you know, if you're on one of the pipelines and like HIDA is like, this place is, you know, Memphis is, you know, they get the okay, they get what they need. Like, there's all these little things that kind of say this is an important spot for whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And like, that goes to, like, you got to have the assets. So when the FBI calls up and Secret Service, like, we're going to hit this warrant, it's on this. Like, they want what you said. They want someone that they know is going to go in, you know, bang that door, grab the dudes. You know, they're not going to beat somebody up. They're not looking to go ahead hunting. They're professionals. They're going to go and do that. And then they can go in and do their job. They're not going to mess up the scene. They're not going to be, you know. And so I learned a lot of stuff in SWAT. But not a lot of it, hardly any of it, was being an investigator, right? You learn all that in patrol, I think. I mean, you learn the foundations, right?
Mm-hmm.
You learn, like, what is PC, like, what is, like, how to treat people, how to talk to people. Because it's not about, like, you know, you see the movies and they're, like, yelling at somebody. Like, I've seen a lot of confessions and I've never seen anybody. Every time I saw somebody, like, just be like, yeah, you're right. The dude was just, like, he was being straight up. He's like, look, man. Like, you know what this is about. You know what you did. Like, I'm going to give you a chance to come clean. Like, I know X, Y, and Z. And I'm going to let you talk. And the minute you start lying, it's just like, you know, it's professional. Yeah. Nobody's hitting people with phone books. Mm-mm. Nobody's doing nothing. They're just working that box. And you're like, damn, this dude is slick. Or, you know what, the guy's like, man, just give me a piece of paper. I'll tell you whatever. Because they know the game.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that too, like you're saying, when you were specialized in SWAT. And so now you get to see an investigator who does the equivalent of what you do.
But I have no idea how to do what he's doing.
Yeah, but then you can respect that and go, in their realm, that's it. And that's how I was. Like, I love shooting. I love doing drills. I love doing vehicle extraction, shooting through car windows, like all that stuff. I love. Now, I joke and nerd about a lot of stuff, but, man, I love it. But I didn't want to do that as a job. I loved, like, any chance I got to either interview someone or flip someone into an informant and then work that intel angle and then go hands-on. So I can pass it off to a gang unit, a drug unit, or even a SWAT team and just be like, hey, look, just flip this guy. This guy's got a gun. He's posted up at this store. This is what he's wearing, his background, convicted felon, all that. And then they roll in, do their thing, like surgeons, get him in custody. And it's like, oh, I love having that asset. But then also, like you said, patrol. And I tell a lot of people this when they'll ask me like, well, I really just want to be an FBI agent, or I really want to be a detective. I don't want to deal with patrol. And they kind of act like it's not beneath them, but like they don't understand patrol was like, is everything. That is
like, FBI is like, they're not really cops, right? Like, that's why they have like cops on an FBI task force, you know, because they don't know the city. They get moved. Yeah. And so what I've always told everybody is like, yeah, I was in the police, but I wasn't really a cop. Like, you know, I was more or less doing what I did in the military there. I learned some stuff or whatever, but like, you know, patrol is what you make it. And I had a lot of fun in patrol. But at the same time, like, there's so many people that are like, this sucks. I want to get out and go do this other stuff.
Yeah.
But like, when I was on, like, when I came on back in the day, like, the only you had to be asked to go to narcotics. You had to be asked, you know, they call it getting a letter. And so they would interview you. They'd be like, hey, but the only way they do that is like, let's say for homicide or detectives, it always started with them reading the reports. Right. They're like, dude, this guy's got like, this dude's got a shit report. And he's just like, you know, unknown male, whatever, whatever. And then you get another report where it's like, hey, you know, this is the dude's name. This is a current address. This is a current phone number.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he happens to know so-and-so who's in the gang database. This is his R&I number or whatever. And then you're like, then, you know, like, I did a follow-up. I did an addendum to, like, the original message, and I found out that, like, this guy doesn't live here anymore, or that word on the streets that this dude do it. And, you're like, that's how, like, you would see, like, when I came in and you're doing the FTO program, you're riding, you really quick get to learn, like, who knows what's up and who's just been in patrol forever because they suck and they're not going anywhere ever, you know?
Yeah.
And like, you want to ride with the dudes who know what's up, and you know, they're kind of teaching you stuff, and they got like, they're doing stuff that no one else is doing. Like, one of my FTOs, like, he like found, he knew the area well enough where people would sell stuff. Like, he would figure out, he would set, like, I think back then Craigslist was a big deal. So someone, I remember the first thing, like, someone stole a bunch of cameras. He goes on Craigslist. He's got pictures and receipts, you know, from, you know, the theft, which he'd put in his report, but whatever. And the detectives weren't really going to do something, but he started his own investigation, like, as a patrolman, got them to come try to, said he was going to go buy it, you know, set up there, like, hey, he's like, told the sergeants, like, look, you know, it was like $2,000 worth of equipment. Can I get an unmarked car? Like, I'm going to go buy this stuff from him. And the guy's like, yeah, if you want to. So, during his shift, he got an unmarked car, goes out there, busted him with all that stuff, like $5,000 extra, you know? And so it's a long way to say, like, I believe that, like, if that foundation's not strong in patrol, and by foundation, I don't mean just the skill, but like, hey, this dude doesn't want to go to another unit and skate just because he wants to, like, have a beard and whatever. He, like, wants to work. Like, I think that reputation and that skill set's made in patrol.
Yeah, it is. And it's what I saw was when I got on, I was in that era of the crime fighter. And so everybody's like, oh, that's cheesy, you know, and I've talked about it on the podcast before. But my first chief was from NYPD. And she just was like, I need y'all to be crime fighters. Like, you're in a district where we're having shootings every week. Your plot of land is only so many square miles. And some beats were not even a square mile. I mean, you're talking about basically like housing area, but that's where the violence is. It's like, you're the patrol officer. You should be the first line of intel and the first line of enforcement. So obviously you can go out there and arrest everybody for small violations. But if these shootings are happening, I need you as patrol officers to be telling the detectives the lay of the land, like what's going on. I mean, it was exactly what I wanted and needed. I wanted someone to give me the autonomy to go out there and do what I needed to do in that area, that beat. I do see the trend within the last few years to be less proactive, less hands-on. Like, a lot of departments would not allow an officer to start an investigation like that, take a report, and then all of a sudden go on Craigslist, you know, start building this stuff. Some supervisors would just be like, whoa, that's a detective's job, and they're trying to hand it off, not understanding the detective has 80 open cases very similar to that, and they're trying to type supplements. They don't always care about what's going on right then as much as that officer does. And then that officer learns how to do that, should get the gigs like in the detective division. And like you said, with homicide, I was always scanning the crowd, like, where's the next talent coming from? And I could pick it on patrol and say, that officer one day will be a phenomenal detective and will be an incredible homicide detective, and have been able to do that sometimes. But it's that idea of just saying, who's motivated, who cares enough, and leave them alone and let them do what they do, and then give them what they need. You know, the officer's like, I need an unmarked car. Get them an unmarked car. We used to go rent cars for like $25 that were busted up cars. Sometimes like a window would be broken, a busted up pickup. Slap $25 down, an officer would get in plain clothes, ride around an area, and people would just flag them down, trying to sell them dope, jump out and snatch them up, and they got, you know, drugs on them. It was just this era of being able to do that and then giving people the freedom. I asked the question earlier about the limitations for time before you apply for SWAT for a specialized unit like that, because it came up in a meeting one day, and I said, I really do believe we need to strip away any kind of set time limits or time frames, because we are short-staffed, our recruiting is suffering. So the military kind of did this a while back. People can and go right out of basic training into selection for units, and they may not make it because they're going straight out of basic, but they still enlisted. You still get them in the door, and we don't know what the talent's going to be coming in. So I don't know. I might have a Josh Hood getting out of the military, coming to the department, and then gets off of patrol, puts in for SWAT, smokes the process, because the department they had a process set in place, could smoke it and be a top asset. One of the best officers I ever worked with on the gang unit had less than 2 years on the department. He got on the unit. We were all big fans of his. He gets on the unit, and then they change policy and say you have to be 4 years on patrol before you can even put your name in the hat to go into the unit. So this poor guy was on the unit, and by the new policy, he didn't even meet the requirements because he only had 2 years on to just be an incredible officer. And I always just kind of learned from that. I thought, man, I want people to pay their dues. I just also think there's hidden talent out there that if you would have had to wait for 3 years, that's a year and a half that they wouldn't have gotten that kind of talent and that work out of you. So I always just,
I mean, that's what like the FBI does, the DEA, all this. I mean, you don't go into some shit job before you become a special agent. You go to the academy and then you go become a special agent.
Yeah.
And like, you know, that's just like my opinion. I see, like, yeah, I didn't even think, like, if you're short staffed or whatever, but, you know, the only flip side I see about that is, like, you know, you got to have people in patrol. Right. Yeah. And so my thought has always been like, you know, two things, like schools and patrol. Like, you have people go to schools to be the school resource officer, and they're like, they're old. They're like, I don't want to do crap. Right. And that's kind of, if when the violence sometimes that happens in the school, you need like the better trained type SWAT dudes, but they're not going to go there. And then, you know, you have for like patrol, the same thing is like, we'll put our turds on this shift, whatever. And, you know, there's no incentive to keep anybody on patrol or incentive to go to schools. Like, but there is an incentive to go like, you know, to a specialized unit because it's cool or you make more overtime or whatever. And it's like, I feel that like a lot of what we see happening is, you know, it's all stat driven, right? Someone at the top's like, well, we got like 50% crime of stolen cars or whatever happening over here. And it's like five cars, right? They're on the phone. Like you might've lost me, but they're on the phone, like bitching somebody out. And so, you know, it goes down the hill and the patrol supervisor's like, hey, we need to be out there writing a bunch of tickets. So everybody knows we're out there. And then, so you're not really in the neighborhood or whatever. And so, you know, I feel that like, if you're doing the stuff in patrol, right, if you're in the streets, if you're doing those interviews, you're riding the neighborhoods, you're talking to people, you're getting a feel, then like that alleviates their pressures up there with the other, you know, detectives and everything else. But I feel like the flip side, it works opposite, right? It's so it's like, how do you keep people in patrol, or how do you like make people want to be in patrol? Like, how do you, you know, is there ability? We had a couple of things that kind of happened where it was like they would take, I can't remember what the name of it was, but like basically they would take the best patrol officers who had, you know, the highest stats or whatever. And on every Friday, they would be like what they call an X car, where they'd be able to come in. The car would be like an undercover car. They would come in like just plain clothes. And since we had enough people on that shift, like they would be allowed to just be like, go out and kind of act like miniature, like narcotics or detective dudes. You know, and like that was something that people would be like, dude, I got to make sure that I get like something so I get a chance to get on that, you know, and then just something like that where it's like, hey, we got enough people where, you know, like it seems like patrol, a lot of times people are just all about like what you look like. Are your boots shined? Are you like, you know, are you being nice to everybody? Like, we don't want you to really be a cop. You're just like, that's what they view. Like, the public looks at us at through the patrol officers, and maybe they do, but like most times, like the public's like, I don't care what you look like or if you come correct, like we don't like cops, and nothing's going to change that.
And the interesting thing about when you're talking about that incentive, we finally got back to that in the last probably year, doing like special assignments is what they call it. Like you take a district and go, okay, this sergeant is going to be, you know, now on a secondary shift, and that person picks, or the captain picks, 4 to 6 officers. And for 30 days, that's what they do. They run and gun and do that stuff. They learn all those skills. They do search warrants. They do all this stuff. And it has gotten officers really, really excited about patrol and staying with the department. But a lot of departments have gotten away from that. And that was that kind of that proving ground of just do it. Like, man, we were patrol officers and we started using ghillie suits to get into hide spots to watch guys sell drugs and to film gang members doing hand signs, like secret handshakes and stuff. Yeah. And it was all like fascinating stuff to me. Then nobody came in one day and said, hey, anybody got some camouflage or ghillie suit or something? Like, we just said, look, we got to get in the wood line close enough to this little neighborhood here that's like right out on the edge of the county. How do we get into play there? I'm like, I got it, man. Let's do this. And we had a sergeant that was like, I don't care what y'all do. Make this stuff go away. We're like, yeah, we'll do it. So that freedom to do that. Yeah. Then we taught the next group of rookies coming in on our squad. Like, we had built in secondary days where our squad would not answer any dispatches. Somebody else was primary and we would go out there and play as an entire squad. So people could run radar if they wanted to. We would always work our drug areas. We would work, you know, arrest warrants, but it was that ability to do that. I brought in a camo net and we put a camera on a tripod and camouflaged it. And we're recording these clubs where guys will come out of clubs firing guns and stuff and getting in car chases, but you've got it on film, but you're utilizing other things that no one's walking in as a leader and telling you and teaching you how to do that. That's what I do want departments to kind of get back to. I do think that if officers can do that, they'll enjoy the job more. Obviously the community needs it. And I do want to say too, that your background like that in the military, in police work, working with weapons and stuff like that, obviously it translates into your writing. That's why I always tell people, like, just pick up the books, check them out. You'll dig it. How can people, before I wrap up, I've got one quick question. All right. I always forget this. How can people reach you? Like social media, website, stuff like
that. Yeah, it's on Instagram, Facebook, all that. It's Joshua Hood Books. And then my website is, I think, Joshua Hood Books. It's all pretty simple.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good. And no one else has your name.
Nope. Should be the only place. But yeah, good. Yeah, man. So, dude, I really appreciate the chance to come on here. It's always good catching up. And
yeah, you know, man. I've been trying to get everything lined up, so I appreciate you being patient with me. One question I do have, are you still listening to music a whole lot, or do you mess around with music, or are you just pretty bland with that?
I mean, I listen to music, you know, a lot. Like, my wife got this Alexa, so, like, I'll wake up in the morning and want to crank on the music, and she's always like, turn that off, you know, it's too early or whatever. But yeah, like, I don't really listen to any new music,
right?
Yeah, not that there's anything wrong with it, but you know, it's just like not my thing, you know. Yeah. Like, I was letting my daughter, like, she'll kind of mess around. We were listening to Black Flag the other day, and she's like, kind of, you know, whatever. And then, like, you know, you listen to some of the older band, like the remote, like, because, like, you can now ask Alexa, like, hey, do you have the stereo remastered? And it sounds totally different, but you're listening to some of the older stuff, and it's like, it's like almost sounds like that mono. And my son's like, why does it sound so funny? And I was like, dude, that's the way, like, things didn't, like, used to be like HD, you know, this is how, like,
yeah,
you know, like hearing that pop of the old record or whatever, mm-hmm. like, you know, it's crazy. So,
yeah. Yeah. I'm always curious, because I know, like, even having the skate background, like you mentioned Black Flag and stuff like that, I just think, like, for me, I'm still listening to a lot of the same old bands, but I do get introduced to new music now, and it's so easy. You just pop on Spotify or any of these platforms, or, like you said, with Alexa, and you just throw it out there. And I'm going a little soft on my music today, but Houndmouth is a band that I'm going to go check out tonight with my girlfriend, and it's one of those bands that I love. She put me on them, and when I talk about it, people are like, oh, that's not punk rock, you're always talking about punk rock. I'm like, yeah, I know, but I also listen to all kinds of other music, and this is more of like a newer type band to me. This is just a little more mellow.
I'll check that out. What is it called?
Really? Yeah, Houndmouth. So it would kind of be, I don't know, man, how you would kind of describe it, but more like probably what you heard on the radio sort of in the late 70s, you know, but with a modern feel and energy. But it's kind of like that, just like a lot of it's like just really mellow, but really great lyrics and songwriting and stuff. And then obviously, like, when I got to crank something up a little loud, it's like, the newer music's like Terror or Wisdom in Chains, you know, and then I shift back to the old days, like a little Minor Threat, you know, stuff like that. But anyway, man, well, look, I'm glad you were able to jump on with me today, man. I appreciate it. I want to get you back on in the future.
Yeah, definitely.
I know we dove into some police stuff that I know a lot of people will send me messages. I tell everybody right now, reach out to Josh. If he's cool with that, you reach out to him. Ask him those questions, man, because that's a big thing that a lot of people I'm finding are asking questions about police work, and they're sick of everybody being negative and these former cops that are out here with social media and podcasts, but they're just downing it and saying, oh, the job is dead, you know.
I mean, I think, like, I haven't heard any of that, and that kind of, like, really surprises me. But I think that, like, what I see a lot of is, like, cops wanting to be, like, Navy SEALs. And that's not the job, dude. If that's what you want. Right. Like, for me, like, you know, I liked what I did, but I knew I wanted to go be on SWAT, right? That's, like, mm-hmm. That's what I wanted to do. I enjoyed, like, my time, like, in patrol. You know, I got to work with a bunch of people, but, like, that's not the job, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And, like,
yeah.
And so, like, I think that, like, there's a lot of people And you go back to like right when I was getting out, I kind of saw like the writing on the wall with the, you know, you had like the Black Lives Matter thing. You had like, there was like this implosion where like cops became the bad guys, right?
Mm-hmm.
And like, you know, I catch my son sometimes, you know, like when I was a kid, like calling a police officer a cop was bad. Mm, you know, like, okay. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? Like if you say, hey, yeah. look at that cop, like that was like a bad thing to say, right? Mm-hmm. And like, but also when I grew up, like being a police officer or like, let's take firemen.
Mm-hmm.
People look at firemen a little different than they look at cops, right? And it's like, they're kind of, I felt, and I could be wrong, but there's like a different type of respect. And then, but when the, because when they come up, show up, they're going to help you. When most people think that when the police show up, like you're in trouble, you're going to jail, you screwed something up. That's just part mm-hmm. of the job, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's like, it's kind of respectable to be a fireman, but it's not as respectable to be a cop. Like, it, and I don't mm-hmm. know if that makes sense, but it's like, you know, like, oh, you're a trash man. That's awesome. Like, oh, you're a cop. You know,
yeah, no,
you're an idiot. Well, you couldn't get mm-hmm. a real job or something. And yeah. I think that it's important that like people, especially guys who have worn the badge, like, you know, not to like down it, because like, I think a lot of people down it because like they're, you know, they've been hammered with this, like you're part of the problem. This like kind of, there's always going to be some bad apples. Right. But like some of the best people I know in the world, smartest, mm-hmm. you know, most like empathetic, most caring, giving have been police officers. Right. And like, you would yeah. never know they were a cop, like off duty or whatever,
mm-hmm.
but it's like we in the world is focused so much on the on the people who've done bad things. And that's not to be accepted. We don't want those
right.
bad apples in there, but that tiny fraction is nowhere near like representative of the profession as a whole. Mm-hmm. But I think that like there's people that are out there that have been jaded and people that have been made to feel bad about it. And they want to say like, you know, like there's nothing better you could do for your community than to stand up and swear to protect it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And if like you're down in the job and you're down in, that's the thing that's always driven me crazy is like, step up and do something. Don't be mm-hmm. like a 25-year or 15-year patrolman. Like step mm-hmm. up and get a leadership position where you're like a sergeant. Like I never did because I knew that as a sergeant, you could get moved off the team. Mm-hmm. But I know guys who did that were mm-hmm. like, hey, you know, like I'm tired of bitching about it. I want to be part of the solution. Yeah. And they took the test and now they're lieutenants, captains or whatever. And then you can change that community. But, you know, it's like for people to be talking crap about that, like I just really would say that's a personal thing. Something yeah. happened to them and they don't really understand that, like, maybe they never understood the job in the first place.
Yeah, I kind of feel that way. I feel like the people that are doing that were probably not in it. Maybe for the right reasons or their heart. I mean, maybe bad things happen to them. I don't know, but I'm with you. The best people, complete, you know, focus and caring for the community and literally putting their life on the line every day when they would go out and patrol neighborhoods, them there. But other people would say, oh, well, you know, the community's scared of the police. And that's, and it's like, no, that area right there that we're seeing the most violence in, behind closed doors, 90% of those families are rooting us on. They just can't do it out in the middle of the parking yeah. lot or at the city park or in front of a news camera because they're surrounded by gang members and violence. But they want us there more than anyone else yeah. probably in the country can understand.
Well, they need us there. And it's like, hey, yeah. if you're going to be a shitbag, you should go to jail. Because at mm-hmm. the end of the day, like, we're all human beings protected by the Constitution. And just because you have a badge doesn't make you right.
Right. Yeah.
And people, I think, like lose sight of that like you're a servant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And at the end of every day, like that's what it comes down to is you serve the community and that's the best part about it. You should be able to take pride in that and block out the negativity. And that's why I tell anybody listening to this yeah. is even thinking about police work, go do it. And just like Josh is saying, it's the best thing you can do. And if you only do it for 4 or 5 years or whatever, and you go, you know, I'm going to move on to another job, then perfect. I mean, it's the yeah. same as serving the military. You do an enlistment and then you get out and, you know, you've done something that fulfills that need or that drive you had. So I'm going to end it on that. I appreciate it, Josh.
Thanks, man. Always a pleasure.
Yes, sir, buddy. It's Disruptors out.